Hey, this is Kathleen. Before we get started, the Living Planet team has some exciting news. Starting in September, we'll be devoting a regular episode to answering your questions. Questions you have about the environment and climate change, questions about an episode you've heard, or even questions about us. You can write to us in the comment section on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or your favorite podcast app. Or you can send us a good old-fashioned email at livingplanet@dw.com. That's living as in not dead, and planet as in the place we all live, at dw.com. Thanks, and we can't wait to hear from you. Now, let's start the show.
I can still remember feeling like I didn't quite know how to prepare. We literally were going to be sort of beyond the reach of human civilization for 3 months. I can remember talking to someone who said, pack as if you're going to the moon. And I thought that was pretty useless advice, considering that I had never been to the moon. I had a very hard time sleeping the night before, and I can remember waking up at like probably 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning and running up to the bridge, which is where the captain steers the ship. And it's kind of this room with like windows on all sides in the shape of a V. And I ran up there, and the light was sort of this like bruised blue color, and I could just see the ice edge kind of emerging out of that gloaming. And it was really stunning. The only point of reference I have for it is it looked sort of like the wall in Game of Thrones. And yet we drew really close to it, and you could see all these incredible patterns and sort of like torqued surfaces. And some places it looked like, you know, the edge of a giant clam. And in other places it was sheer and vertical. And once you spend a lot of time with the ice, you start to recognize that it has all these different shades to it. So it's not just white. It's, you know, a deep cerulean blue and foggy grays. And it was just really beautiful to watch all of these different sort of shades of white emerge. I had never seen anything like it in my life.
There's a reason people compare it to moonscapes and fantasy realms. It's a place few people ever see, one that we're still trying to understand. Vast, mysterious, otherworldly, and yes, cold, they say. Really, really cold. Antarctica, the end of the Earth. A wild, pristine expanse of thousands of kilometres of ice, howling wind, towering glaciers. Home to some 20 million penguins, 6 species of seal, and, ever increasingly, cruise loads of tourists.
We got up at 6 a.m. to watch the ship set sail to Antarctica. So exciting! Then we grabbed a coffee and headed to the buffet for breakfast. The pool area was looking so pretty, but it was time to head down to get out.
Once aboard, we jumped into mandatory safety briefings, picked up our expedition gear, and even vacuumed all of our outerwear to protect Antarctica's ecosystem.
Okay, so the lounge. This is the first place we walked into when we boarded. There's a bar. The whole ship is open bar. Even when the bars are closed, you can get drinks to room service.
And then the captain told us to secure our cabins because the night was going to get rough. Let's hope he's wrong.
Once the domain of explorers and scientists, and maybe the odd millionaire, visiting Antarctica used to be truly out of the ordinary. No one even stepped foot on the continent until 1820. In the 1950s, just a few hundred visitors made the journey each year. By the 1990s, it was several thousand. Fast forward to now, and tourism to the seventh continent is booming. Last year, a record 124,000 tourists visited Antarctica. That was nearly triple pre-pandemic numbers in 2019. And it doesn't look to be slowing down. Tourism operators expect even more people in the coming seasons. many drawn by the promise of seeing a disappearing world before it's gone, or overrun. But as more and more cruise ships rock up, more and more people are asking, is it ever environmentally defensible to travel to a place like this? To put Antarctica on your bucket list? Because, as scientists warn, the very act of visiting is helping speed up its decline. Today on Living Planet, we're diving into that dilemma. What's tourism doing to Antarctica? And what does this tell us about how we should treat other wild places? I'm Charlie Shield.
I had spent the previous decade almost, starting in 2010, I'd been writing about the early impacts of sea level rise on coastal communities all around the world. And I really wanted to see the source of those changes up close.
Elizabeth Rush is a writer and an assistant English professor based at Brown University in Rhode Island. In 2019, she flew from North America to the southernmost tip of South America, Punta Arenas in Chile, where she boarded an icebreaker headed for West Antarctica. She was joining a scientific mission to Thwaites Glacier as an artist in residence. Aboard the icebreaker were scientists, researchers, and crew members, a total of 57 people.
It was a really phenomenal mix. So we had folks from Great Britain, Norway, Brazil. A lot of the crew was from the Philippines and Germany, Scotland. There were folks from all over the world on this boat. And that was a really interesting, neat aspect of what we were doing.
It took them a whole month of voyaging through the Southern Ocean aboard the icebreaker to reach Thwaites Glacier. It's one of the world's most critical glaciers for determining how much sea levels will rise over the next century. That's why it's often called the Doomsday Glacier, because it's about the size of Great Britain and it acts as a kind of cork for the West Antarctic ice sheet, holding a heap of its ice in place.
And because of where it sits in Antarctica, no boat had ever reached the place where the ice meets the sea. And so our mission was really to gather as much information as humanly possible about this really critical intersection between ice and ocean.
2019 was the first year in recorded human history that the ocean right in front of the glacier had melted enough to allow scientific missions to get up close.
In fact, it opened up just like a week or two before we arrived. And so we had this very unique opportunity to draw incredibly close to the glacier.
They spent a month at and around the glacier, deploying different sensory devices, collecting data, and studying this frozen area of the world that no one else had ever been to.
It was stunning. I mean, it, in some ways, I felt like any language that I could lob at the ice kind of just slid right off. I felt like I was in the best episode of National Geographic most of the time.
Elizabeth interviewed everyone on board the icebreaker several times and helped with basic scientific projects.
We had a couple of days where we had to get on little Zodiac boats and motor over to some remote island chains where our task was to stick epoxy-like transmission devices to the foreheads of elephant seals. And the males are like 2 and 3 tons and they look sort of like gigantic puffed cows. They bark and they were just sort of like really funny creatures. We saw humpback whales breaching and flying out of the air and twisting all around. There's lots of really interesting seabirds that migrate to Antarctica.
And though this place is harsh and bone-chilling up top, little do many people know that hiding beneath Antarctica's icy surface is a kind of technicolor universe.
People tend to think of Antarctica as a pretty barren place, but I think some of the most exciting things are happening in the ocean around Antarctica. So you have all of this krill, and then you have all of these whales that travel down to Antarctica to eat the krill. And so we were there during summer, and yeah, the underside of the ice has like all different shades to it because of the krill, pinks and reds and orange, and that's the bottom of the food chain for all of these larger marine mammals.
Elizabeth got to know this landscape, a small part of it anyway, and what she experienced left a lasting impression.
One of my favorite days, we deployed to a few remote island chains right in front of the Thwaites, and our task was to basically beach comb and look for ancient penguin bones. Although it was about negative 20 Celsius and it was freezing, we were in multiple layers of clothing. We got to spend a whole day on this island where we were amongst the only humans to have ever touched it in the history of the planet.
She then spent the next 5 years turning that experience into a book called The Quickening, Creation and Community at the Ends of the Earth. It's about the journey, the science, what she learned about herself, climate change, and how we live and act in the face of it all. Because even though we often think of Antarctica as being at the end or the edge of the Earth, far away, peripheral, in climate terms, it's less like an edge, more like an engine. What we do there matters everywhere.
People say Antarctica is like the piston in the pump that drives ocean circulation currents. It determines weather all over the world. So even though we're very far away from Antarctica every day, some part of your life is absolutely touched by the continent, shaped by the continent.
For a long time, the only people venturing to Antarctica were explorers, researchers, and scientists aboard data-gathering missions like the one Elizabeth joined. And the stories they brought back were the closest that ordinary folk could get to this place. But in the past several decades, that has started to change. Increasing numbers of people are travelling to the world's most remote continent as tourists, lured by the prospect of a wild, unique, fast-disappearing experience.
To the edge of the world and beyond, where the silence is not empty, but full of ancient whispers. This is Antarctica, the white continent, a realm where ice stretches wide beneath the clearest of skies, and nature's untamed beauty reigns.
What nature gives us. The entertainment is not on board, it's outside. And I always, or nearly always, say to the guests, look around you, because that is something that is like nowhere else on Earth. It is unique. Embrace the unknown. That is how you will get the best experience.
At the beginning of this year, the luxury American travel magazine, Condé Nast, published its annual list of the best places to go in 2025. For the first time, Antarctica made that list. And there's a reason it's marketed to wealthy travellers looking for luxury experiences. Visiting Antarctica as a tourist on a cruise or expedition will set you back between $15,000 to $80,000. And that doesn't even include getting to the departure points, which are located in southern South America, South Africa, Tasmania, and New Zealand. These days, tour operators are also increasingly offering fast-track trips, where you can skip sailing through the infamously rocky Drake Passage and complete a trip in as few as 6 to 8 days. They're also increasingly offering new expeditions to previously unexplored areas of Antarctica.
I view it with some concern.
That's Ellie Lean. She's a professor of Antarctic Studies at the University of Tasmania. That's the little island at the bottom of Australia, closer than most to Antarctica. Ellie's written several books about the continent, and she recently co-authored a study about over-tourism in Antarctica. She's talking about concern for the uptick in visitors.
Maybe that's a little bit hypocritical from someone who's been to Antarctica multiple times.
Ellie's been to Antarctica 4 times now. And each time, it's given her a greater appreciation of the majesty, the preciousness and the huge importance of life on Earth. So why the concern?
It's not that I think tourism shouldn't exist. I just worry about the skyrocketing numbers. It is increasing exponentially, and at the moment there's nothing to stop it doing so indefinitely.
Antarctica is governed by a coalition of nations that have signed what's called the Antarctic Treaty. So that's 58 nations in total, but only 29 of them have decision-making rights. The peak body that manages tourism there is called the International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators, or IATO for short.
And IATO does a lot of good. It puts in a lot of rules and guidelines for what operators can and can't do.
Visits are highly regulated by IATO, in particular to protect the biosecurity of this continent. Tourists are only permitted to step foot in certain zones of land. They must thoroughly clean their clothing before arriving to prevent the spread of non-native pests. And they must keep at least 5 metres or 15 feet from wildlife at all times, and further away if they're breeding. Cruise ships are also only permitted to use approved lighter-grade marine fuels because of the Antarctic heavy fuel oil ban.
If you go on a vessel, you'll probably be surprised at just how careful you have to be at what you do. You can't sit on the snow, you can't kneel on the snow, you can't put your backpack on the snow.
These are all important things, Ellie says, but they're still not enough.
But one thing IATO can't do as an industry body is put a cap on numbers. So that has to come from somewhere else, and inevitably it would have to come from the Antarctic Treaty consultative parties. But there's 29 decision-making parties there, and they're all different nations, and they all have different views on tourism, and trying to get them to cap numbers is going to be quite the challenge. There's a lot of discussion about tourism going on at the moment in the meetings, but it's not moving very quickly. So I do think down the track, and not very far down the track, we're going to have to have some fairly serious conversations about how many people can go to Antarctica without really putting the environment at major risk.
Antarctica's harsh, frozen environment might not be fragile, so to speak, but it is vulnerable to the impacts of tourism. The more humans visit, the higher the risk that diseases and invasive species will come too. Humans also bring more pollution, not necessarily in their backpacks, that is definitely not allowed, but via the exhaust pipes of the cruise ships and the ship vessels that they arrive on. In the most popular areas for research and tourism, scientists have found a higher concentration of black carbon on the ice. This effectively turns the ice from white to black, reducing its reflective quality and accelerating melting. Then there are the greenhouse gas emissions required to get there. Travelling to Antarctica is emissions intensive. It's the farthest most people will travel in their lifetimes. Tourists have to take long flights and long cruises in extreme conditions to reach it. That contributes to the climate change that is already causing profound damage to Antarctica. One study published in Nature Communications found that each visitor between 2016 and 2020 was essentially responsible for melting 83 tons of snow each. The researchers and the scientists that travel here are implicated too. Though you could argue that their contributions to climate science offset their emissions to some extent.
But inevitably there's an impact. There's an impact if you go as a scientist, there's an impact if you go as a tourist. Yeah, so you have to justify that to yourself if you can.
On February 25, 2025, Antarctic sea ice reached its minimum extent for the year. And for the seventh year in a row, it was the smallest it's ever been in human history. The continent is melting. That has enormous implications for human life and wildlife far and wide. Antarctica is a home for millions of animals.
You'll see all kinds of different penguins, chinstraps, gentoos, occasionally an emperor if you're really lucky, whales, humpback whales, a lot of whales, as well as the seals. If you go to somewhere like South Georgia, you'll see fur seals, for example, and all kinds of bird life, the albatross, the skuas, the petrels.
It effectively functions like a giant mirror for the planet, reflecting the sun's light and heat, which is crucial for maintaining a stable, habitable global climate. As it melts, global sea levels rise. Since 1880, they've already risen by about 8 to 10 inches or 20 to 25 centimetres, threatening low-lying Pacific Island nations such as Tuvalu, Fiji and the Maldives. Scientists say that coastal communities, such as those along the US East Coast and Gulf Coast, which are already suffering from worsening storm surges and high tide flooding, are right in the firing line of sea level rise due to ice melt.
Now to some dire environmental news. Today, NOAA released a report finding that U.S. coastlines will experience a profound sea level rise by 2050. This comes just one day after...
In a kind of perverse way, this melting is actually making it easier to visit Antarctica, increasing accessibility and extending the summer. Of all of these impacts, the emissions driving global warming are the biggest threat to this continent. And yes, those emissions aren't just produced by people travelling to Antarctica each year. They come from all plane travel all over the world, and mostly from burning coal, oil and gas for energy, and everything else that contributes to emissions. That means, as Ellie Lean points out, many of us are guilty, not just the tourists travelling to Antarctica. It's just that Antarctica is particularly far away, inevitably requiring more carbon emissions to reach. And many people also see Antarctica as simply different, a place of such planetary importance and precious wilderness, so key to a stable climate, it's worthy of special protection.
I think we're beginning to see that it's a lot more important to our livelihoods than we ever realised. So, you know, it's Antarctica's going to be the biggest source of sea level rise down the track. Of anything. And I think we're beginning to realise that, we ignore that at our peril.
This is partly why tourism to Antarctica is often categorised as last chance tourism. That's the idea that you visit a place before it's wrecked or disappears entirely, while it's still intact. This category also includes coral reefs before they're bleached beyond recognition, glaciers before they melt away, and even seeing polar bears in the wild before their habitats disappear.
So there's two different things there, isn't there? I want to see it before climate change changes it irrevocably, and I want to see it before tourism changes it irrevocably. Both of them ironic, because in both cases you are actually adding to the problem by going.
But Ellie, who's researched tourist motivations for visiting Antarctica, says for most people, she doesn't think that that's the main one.
For me, it wasn't a huge motivation for most people. I think that's maybe a little bit overblown in the case of Antarctic tourism. A lot of people are going for, you know, the wildlife and the scenery, as you might expect. Some of them really like the idea of it being a place on the edge, as I do. They have a sense of adventure and they feel like going there is sort of an adventurous thing to do. You do get some people who you might call sort of bucket listers who, you know, they've been to every continent and they want to go to their seventh, which for me is not a great reason to go anywhere collecting continents like that. But not too many people like that. For a number of people, it's really a trip of a lifetime. You know, they've saved up a long time to be able to afford it because for some reason or another, they've always been intrigued by Antarctica.
A lot of tourism to Antarctica is curated with a strong educational element, Ellie says. On board many cruises, there are daily lectures on penguins and the continent's unique history and ecology. It's part of a broader aim, even a justification, for allowing tourism to such a place despite environmental concerns. In fact, the authority that regulates Antarctic tourism, IATA, states on its website that it hopes to foster Antarctic ambassadors through tourism. People who return from their visits inspired to protect the region. But the research on whether that actually happens has produced pretty lukewarm results.
In the literature, there's not a lot of evidence for it. And what evidence there is that it drops off pretty quickly after a few months.
If and how a trip to Antarctica might spark lasting advocacy is something Ellie and her team at the University of Tasmania have been investigating.
And what we've found is that you can't just expect ambassadorship to happen. You can't just send a lot of people to Antarctica, even if you give them lectures and so forth, which is usually the case, and expect they'll come back suddenly knowing what to do to protect it. you need to give people some really clear actions that they can take. You need to make sure that they're informed and they know what they're talking about. You need to support them to take that action, to communicate in appropriate ways.
In other words, the concept of Antarctic ambassadorship might sound promising, but right now it's not having much meaningful impact. That doesn't mean it has no potential, Ellie thinks. But if tourists have any hope of becoming real stewards for Antarctica, what that actually means needs to be clearer, and the ask probably needs to be bigger. Because taking home pro-environmental behaviour is one thing, but actual ambassadorship? That might mean getting involved in Antarctic politics.
The main thing is to be a little bit more conscious of the geopolitics and to be aware of when Antarctica is discussed in the media and to be aware of what their country is doing and its position on various policy issues being discussed in the treaty meeting, and making a bit of noise about that and getting online and, you know, encouraging other people to think about it.
So if ambassadors were able to help shape more respectful, sustainable tourism in Antarctica, what would that actually look like?
I feel like Tourism Antarctica's got to be about Antarctica. It can't be tourism done with Antarctica as a glamorous, adventurous backdrop. It's got to be tourism that really does its best to connect people to that place, make them appreciate that place and make them appreciate how endangered it is. And that can only be a finite amount of people every season.
In practice, that would mean continuing strict biosecurity measures and focusing tours on environmental education, capping visitor numbers, limiting what activities are allowed in Antarctica. Ellie says kayaking, yes, base jumping, no, and introducing something new, a tourist tax.
Have them pay a certain fee that could go to monitoring the checks on the wildlife and checks on the impact of the industry, for example. And perhaps some of that fee could go towards supporting students or people that can't afford to go to Antarctica to experience it. So that would make the industry, that would sort of give back to Antarctica to some extent.
For Elizabeth Rush, who spent 2 whole months voyaging to and from Antarctica aboard an icebreaker, there's something precious worth preserving in the remoteness of this place.
200 years ago, no one had ever been there before. Like, there's something really phenomenally powerful about the ice and how it held humans at arm's length for most of our history. And I would love to see us honor that.
She's also cautious not to lose sight of the contradictions inherent in traveling such a vast distance to a vulnerable ecosystem in the name of protecting it, and how this could distract us from other environmental work to be done closer to home.
When we think about what it means to become an ambassador to the ice, I think it's also important to remember that this is actually a place that has pretty decent laws protecting it already. It might be more useful to become an ambassador to a landscape that's in your backyard that isn't as equally protected.
When Elizabeth did eventually depart Antarctica all those years ago, she was struck by the simplicity of the lessons that she was taking back with her.
I remember the feeling of crossing back over the Southern Ocean and the Drake's Passage and kind of feeling Antarctica recede behind me. I knew that I would never come back, in part because it felt like the only way that I could justify having gone in the first place was the fact that I was going to then devote 5 years of my life to writing a book about it. I would say it didn't fundamentally shift how I saw climate change. It did teach me something about what it meant to live with a couple dozen other people and have to really work hard to achieve a set of shared goals. Like, if we're going to survive a world that's falling apart, we have to learn to do it together. And that's the way one might be able to continue forward in this time of great loss.
Not just awe, not just urgency, but how to work together. This This episode of Living Planet was produced by me, Charlie Shields. It was edited and mixed by Neil King. Our sound engineer was Ziad Abu Sleiman. What did you think of this episode? We'd love to hear your thoughts. Send us an email or a voice note to livingplanet@dw.com. And if there are any climate or environmental issues you'd like us to cover, or if you have specific questions about the environment and your role that you'd like us to try and help you find the answer to, send those in as well. If you're listening to this on the radio, remember that you can find and subscribe to Living Planet on any podcast platform, which is also where you can leave us a rating and a review if you're feeling extra nice. Thank you so much for listening. Living Planet will be back with a new episode next week.
On this season of Threshold, we'll meet people who are devoting their lives to listening to what other beings are saying.
These animals have incredible social lives. We need a better understanding of how important sound is in their society.
It was a sound that I was completely unfamiliar with, and I could be confident that no human had ever heard that sound before.
Find Threshold wherever you listen to podcasts.